The second new play to be presented at the Globe this season is Liberty, written by Lynn Maxwell and directed by Guy Retallack. Set in the French Revolution during the Terror of 1793-4, it chronicles the descent of Évariste Gamelin from young radical to murderous extremist, and the effect that this has on a small group of his friends. My name is Heather Neal, and I'm at the Globe now with Glyn Maxwell, who is a poet and novelist as well as a playwright, of course, and has a new novel out called The Girl Who Was Going to Die, and is his new volume of poetry is about to come out any minute, and he's just told me he's also got a new play going on at Theatre 503. What's that called?
It's called Mimi and the Stalker.
Right. And when's that?
That opens on the 16th, September the 16th right. of 503, okay. Yeah.
So it's Glyn Maxwell's Autumn. Well, thank you for making time to come and talk to Theatre Voice. We should begin, I expect, by saying that Liberty is based on Anatole France's 1912 novel, Les Dieux ont Soif, which it's implied they're thirsty for blood.
Yeah.
Obviously, it means the gods are thirsty. So what attracted you first to this as potential material for a play, and how did you go about adapting a novel for the stage? Because it's never an easy thing to do that.
Yeah, well, I worked with Guy Retallack as director and Sue Scott Davison in my play The Lifeblood about Mary, Queen of Scots, and Sue played the played Mary. And because that went very well up in Edinburgh, and we had a certain amount of momentum, and we set up this theatre company, Lifeblood Theatre Company, and we were looking for another project to do with Sue as producer and Guy as director, and we've been casting around with various ideas, and then a friend of mine had been urging me for ages to read this book by Anatole France, and I said, yeah, at some point I'll get around to it. Eventually I did get around to it, and I just immediately felt this was what I was looking for, the next commission should be this. Because with Lifeblood, we'd done a historical play, but we tried to do it in a very contemporary, clear way, and this felt like the next thing to do. And then, you know, these years were 2003-4. These were years of fast-moving international events, and I felt that the descent of Évariste Gamelin from idealism to sort of to being an apologist for violence or to bloodthirstiness or whatever just seemed to have parallels that were going on internationally, and I felt I didn't want to write a play about what was going on internationally, because you write anything now then it's in the air and it kind of comes out, so I went ahead. I knew this novel was the one to do. I mean, in terms of adaptation, the novel's really quite panoramic. It has a lot of threads. I couldn't really use all of them, and this was even before I knew it was going to be at the Globe, which tempts you into a sort of sprawl, you know, it tempts you to expand and make a thing bigger. Even before that, I thought this should just be about five or six people, so I just used some of the strands from the novel and not others.
And you start with the picnic, which isn't at the beginning of the novel, I think.
Yeah, that's right. The picnic in the novel is sort of in the middle. I like the idea of having of the sort of brightness of a picnic, the symbolism of a picnic where diverse people come to eat and drink and be merry. I wanted that to sort of psychologically represent the idealism of the revolution. I mean, I think people forget that 1789 wasn't all that bloody. You know, there was the odd lynching. And the Bastille was relatively bloodless.
And there's hardly anybody in there.
That's right. There were really sort of five people or something. And then a year later, they had a celebration in 1790 that was almost sweet in its idealism. And the period that we know of as the Terror, the thing that the French Revolution is famous for, is really two or three years after that. So I wanted the picnic to kind of reflect the initial bloodlessness and sweetness of it.
But nevertheless, the French Revolution is a huge subject, and you can't assume that your audience here is going to know much about the background. So was that something you had to address early on, sort of get as much information in as possible.
Yeah, yeah, and one tries to do it as subtly as possible. I mean, I thought of a group of people trying to have a picnic to get away from tumultuous events, and so Rose, the actress, tries to stop anyone talking about it by you know, having a little game that you know other characters don't want to talk about. Of course, Everest runs away from the picnic so that he can make his speech to the trees about it to be alone. But other people don't want to talk about it. This actually, I lived in America when 9/11 happened, and it was something similar about that. You know, people trying, let's just not talk about any of this for a while. You know, although it was always the elephant in the room.
Well, you mentioned the resonances for us. I think there is actually one particular word that you've used, isn't there? Something that Bush said.
Oh, yeah.
He used the word quaint, which you have quoted.
That's right. I mean, it came to light that some people in Bush's Justice Department described certain provisions of the Geneva Convention as being quaint. And, of course, this was the Justice Department that wrote the documents that enabled, you know, whatever happened down the chain of command. But the result of it was the sort of torture and you know, degradation of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. That word always stuck with me, and I gave that to Philippe, the sort of happy-go-lucky character and sort of epicure who when he's told that trials are going to be quicker now because they're not going to bother with witnesses and proof or anything like that, well, it always did seem rather quaint. I think we might have cut that line in the end, but I was happy to have it there. I mean, you know, maybe it's a little unsubtle, but it was a word that stuck out grotesquely from the last few years.
But generally you have let the resonances speak for themselves. You haven't obviously drawn parallels that are too obvious for us.
No, that's the thing. I mean, whatever one writes about, I mean, if you're writing now, then the things are in the air. The language just behaves in that way because things are in the air. So, yeah.
Which is the word terror, I mean.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, you're not forcing anything to say that a revolutionary like Gamelin would say all these beautiful ideals will be passed into law once we're out of danger. And of course, it sounds exactly like people saying we only have to do this surveillance and so on, or rendition or whatever, because we're in danger. But you don't have to push it to see the parallel. But that's exactly what the French revolutionaries did say.
Yes. Although you have a line about how we will take for granted all the things eventually that they were fighting for.
Yeah,
and we do.
Yeah, I wanted. I mean, the virtually the last lines I give to Gamelin before he goes to the guillotine, you know, are a direct address to us now. You will live in Eden one day, and you'll curse it to the last petal. And I just felt, when you think about the parts of the world that don't have the things we have, you can cavil about how much equality, how much liberty we have, but you should look at some other parts of the world and see where there's none at all. And you know, forever. I was shocked after 9/11 and the ensuing events. I was shocked by the sort of reflex, knee-jerk anti-Americanism that was rife here, because that could easily turn into some sort of, you know, tacit support for what was attacking Western civilization, and what was attacking it was the absolute opposite of equality and the opposite of liberty and the opposite of brotherhood and sisterhood. So, you know, I'd like to look at these concepts and make us think about them, and how they were fought for, where they came from, and how superficial they are, and how easily vandalized they are, and how easily damaged and fragile they are, as we've seen with the American Constitution recently.
Well, you've taken the characters from the book, but I think you've built up Rose, the rather charming and clever and witty actress, who is beautifully played, I think, by Kirsty Besterman here. So you wanted to give a woman's point of view, or was it not as simple as that?
I just felt that I liked that character, and I'm interested, I suppose... what happens to Rose, Rose's journey, is also about what happens to art and the responsibility of art, because at the beginning she is sort of a frivolous character who doesn't want to talk about events, who really wants life just to be doing her plays and then going out for a drink afterwards.
That is a danger in the theatre, actually, isn't it? It can get separated from the real life it's talking about.
Yeah. So I did bring Rose out much more than she is in the novel, and put her through sort of some of the worst things that could happen to her, so that she ends the play sort of alone, sort of with us. That's what I intended. It looked like she was almost alone in the present world. As the survivor of these events, the implicit thing being, think about what's going on, think about what's happened. Don't, like other characters in the novel and the play, who simply return to their old lives and carry on behaving as they did, as if nothing had happened. And Rose is the absolute opposite. She carries the burden of the events. She carries the burden of the past on into the future, which is us.
Yes, and Philippe too. I think you see him as a representative of us, as it were, in some way.
Yeah, one has to have a little bit of oneself in all the characters, but Philippe, I guess, is a little bit like how I feel I'd be under those circumstances. I'd make caustic comments about it, and run away, which is what he does.
Until he can't run.
That's right. I don't remember intending it to be such a sort of sad little scene, but the scene where he's going to run away, and then he tries to have his moment of bravery by sticking by Rose, but of course they haven't come for him, they've come for her, and all that bravery goes away. So, what was his attempt to stand up and be a hero just horribly backfires, and you see at the end that he is really affected by it, but can't really admit it and just wants to drink it away and go on with life as it was. Yeah.
Well, Évariste presumably is a version of Robespierre, is he?
Yeah, I think also in the novel he's intended to be, yes, a sort of version of Robespierre in miniature, less important, but that's the thing about Robespierre as a young lawyer. For example, he was opposed to the death penalty, which was really a small minority to be in at that point in history. Young Robespierre looks like a very decent person in a lot of ways. And I'd have to say that I think the Évariste in my play is a more likeable character than the Évariste in the novel, who I think Anatole France is clearly set against from the start, and he seems kind of priggish and self-absorbed. And I've sort of fought over the various drafts of this play. Always the challenge was to make us like Évariste, even love Évariste, but really to be with him so that we can follow him into the stages. We can see how he can justify what he becomes. Because
perhaps even there, but for fortune go.
Yeah. I mean, after all, the things that he becomes, on the face of it, he becomes terrible, sending people to the guillotine in their dozens or whatever, but also what he believes in is the foundation of our society now. I mean, those are the very things that were the cornerstones of our civilization.
To go back to the resonances for us, I was interested in how nervous people were about their use of language. That's something that we're very familiar with. Am I allowed to say that now?
Yeah. No, that's right. I certainly wanted to have that. There were certain things you weren't supposed to say, and everybody was kind of supposed to call Marie Antoinette l'Autrichienne, which is sort of pun on bitch. And if you didn't say that, if you said she was the queen or had been the queen, then it was a little suspect. You certainly had this thing being suspect, and on the outer reaches of political correctness on either side of the political spectrum, that I think writers have to be very vigilant about when they see that sort of thing happening. And of course, by the way, right wing and left wing is something that it originates in the revolution.
Yeah. you just said something about how you work, and you do lots of drafts. Do you do lots of research and then do lots of drafts and then workshop it? It sounds a very a long and painstaking progress, or do you then write very quickly when those processes are over and you do the final version?
Yeah, it was actually both things. I do a lot of research. I did read an awful lot for this to really immerse myself in the revolution, and I watched some damn good movies. But the actual writing, when I feel I've got the characters ready, the actual writing is very quick. I mean, I'll just go somewhere very quiet and write for 4 or 5 days, and that will be a draft. And then, we workshop this a lot in different theatres before the Globe saw it and were interested enough to come in for it. This has been quite a long journey, this one. Other things of mine have happened quicker, but this there's a long journey to take with this one, really.
Did coming to the Globe cause you to do any rewriting or changing ideas about staging?
Yeah, a little bit. It had to because originally we expected that we'd get this on at the Fringe or somewhere where it has to be an hour, 20 at the most. The Globe means you have to have an interval, so it has to be a little longer than that. And you can have more characters, and I felt that we would automatically have 12 or 13, 14 dancing, singing extras. I'd seen a lot of shows here, and I thought that's what you got, but we couldn't actually afford that. So the 8 heroic actors do the whole thing. They do all the singing and dancing and being song culotte as well as their roles, which is very, very tough on them all. But it's just. That's the way it is here. We've got the 8 of them. We're taking just the 8 of them on tour, which is partly the reason. So they play the entire rise and fall of the French Revolution.
Were you involved much in rehearsals?
Yeah, a fair bit. I mean, my philosophy is always the same, is that it's up to the director. But I have a good relationship with Guy, a really good creative relationship.
Yes, this production, we should have said, is produced alongside with Lifeblood Theatre, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, production. Yeah. So what Lifeblood brought to it was Guy as director and Sue Scott Davison as producer, I was in rehearsal a fair bit when I could be. I think writers sometimes like it and sometimes it makes them nervous, and I try to be sensitive about that. I've rewritten little things here and there, cut things here and there. It's the Globe is kind of a unique space, so sometimes it demands things of you, and then you realise a week later that you shouldn't have listened to its demands, one can imagine the wrong things about it. We're still learning what to do in this space. It's unique and beautiful. I mean, rehearsing in it was really just a joyful experience, because the place, even when it's not, almost especially when it doesn't have any audience in it, just the sort of silent phalanx of tourists, is just it's almost holy. It's just such a lovely place to be in, especially when the sky is blue,
But it can be quite challenging as well, can't it? You were probably lucky to have 2 or 3 actors who knew the space quite well.
Actually, of the 8, 7 of them had done it before, had played it before, and 2 or 3 of them a lot. So, half the cast are also in Merry Wives, so they're here every day. And I think actors are awe-inspiring, to be honest.
Well, I suppose we ought to mention the reviews. Now, you had, to begin with, there were 1 or 2 really quite unnecessarily vicious responses, and I can't quite understand why. It sort of levelled out since.
It's pathological. I mean, I don't exactly know what the details are. Actually, reading things like that is sort of bad for one's health. But I think there you cross over into some sort of personal thing. And it's shit on your boots, really. You scrape it off and you go on. I've had good and bad reviews my whole writing career. I mean, as a poet 15 years ago, some people thought it was ridiculous what I was doing, and I mean, they've all fallen by the wayside. It is true that if you fish for long enough, the bodies start floating by. So I won't forget these things that were said, and I'll remember them when the bodies float by, to be honest. I mean, the thing about all criticism, even if it's nice, even if it's pleasant, is that it's really nothing to do with the life of the play. When the Lifeblood first went on 7 years ago, it had kind of mediocre reviews that were sort of like, were essentially saying this is this isn't worth seeing. Since then, it's been revived like 6 times in 3 different countries within 7 years. That's the life of the play. So all that tells us. I mean, I'm not obviously, you know, I'm not just speaking like the walking wounded, but I'm just, this is an objective fact that the future of a play is really determined by what the actors take away, what the audience takes away, and you know, and that one person in the audience who thinks, actually, I like this enough to do it myself somewhere. So, you know, that's the life.
Well, in fact, on press night, I was here on press night, the audience seemed to be enjoying it quite a lot, in fact.
Yeah, that's a phenomenon you get in this country of well-paid theatre critics sitting there in a space full of people laughing, crying and cheering, and then they decide, actually, they're all wrong. They're all wrong about this, and I'm right. And that's something that's... I think it's somewhat personal. I think it's a sort of character thing. It's not what determines whether this has a long life or a short life. That's the final word.
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned at all is the fact that this play is written in verse. Now, I wondered, in fact, if the critics being told that had a negative effect before they even came to the theatre. People think they're coming to a verse play these days. They sort of think, oh no, it's Christopher Fry. But in fact, I think most of the people listening to it wouldn't have known it was verse unless they'd been told. Does it matter to you whether we pick up on the fact that it's verse?
No, it doesn't matter at all. In fact, I prefer it if people don't notice, because the verse is really just the way it's to do with the composition of it. It's the way it's composed. It's composed on the breath, so that the lines. Idea of it is that the lines are sort of song on the breath, and this is what I think sustains the best verse drama. And let's not forget, the best verse drama in our theatre is the best drama. I'm not making those claims for my stuff. I'm just saying that it's not so outlandish to be writing in verse. Why the critics have a problem with it, I don't know. You know, ultimately, I just may be better at my job than they are at theirs, because they should just come and listen. They're an audience. Audience is, the word is to do with listening. I know everybody would rather see a dance piece, or they'd rather see a slideshow at the National, you know, but this is quite rich language that you're supposed to listen to. And if you can't hear, if you've been paid for however many years to be a theatre critic and you can't hear the strength in that dialogue, then you shouldn't be doing your damn job.
I have read that your characters start to speak for themselves. Is that right? It sounds sort of mystical, but it's of course all writers say it to some extent.
Yeah. I think if I time it right, and I go into the writing process, which as I said is a very intense, get up at 4 a.m. to see nobody, say nothing for 5 days sort of process. If I can time it just right, then the voices are sufficiently developed that they do appear to run away with me, and sometimes they are speaking to me quicker than I can write it down. There are moments, I mean, I was watching the play last night, and I remember that some of those little pieces are from the very first draft. There's a little bit in the picnic where Rose and Louise and Maurice all speak, and I remember that. I think that's gone unchanged through every draft, because it just felt so automatic, and I almost felt I was writing, I was transcribing, which is a beautiful thing for a playwright or a poet, of course, to feel. And it doesn't always happen. But I think it's a sign that you have a very good sense at that point of who your characters are. Whatever else you're accomplishing, you know you've timed it right.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. For people who want to know more details about Catching Liberty, it's going to be on tour. It'll be here in Rep at the Globe until October the 4th, and then it goes to York, Exeter, Guildford, Oxford, the Warwick Arts Centre and Chichester. And to find out about those dates, either look at shakespeares-globe.org or lifebloodtheatre, all one word, .co.uk. Thanks very much.